Welcome back, everyone. I would like to call upon the second opponent, Professor Anders Friberg, to come forward, please. The floor and the screen are yours.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to come here and talk about these things. Micro timing, as you call it nowadays. It reminds me a lot about the research we did in the 90s, especially regarding J&D measurements and onset determination, this kind of thing. And I'm very happy that actually here in the group you do a lot of stuff in that direction and continue this tradition to go in this direction. By the way, you discussed micro timing here. We used to call it music performance. So I suggest that term.
That's great. It's a great
term. It's very general. Yeah.
It's a great term.
Okay. I have a number of questions here. They are mostly concerned with the methodology, actually. A bit of a contrast to Rainer's questions. However, first I will also do some general question as well. I would like to start with this instruction again that you already discussed, laid back and pushy and on the beat. I was just thinking the meaning you put into that in general. Well, can you say something more about that? In a way, what is people putting into that?
Mm. Well, I can say that I think people can hear me all right from this distance, right? What we put in the experiment, let's say, just to say that it was a very general instruction. I mean, we had both English-speaking and Norwegian-speaking participants, but in English, those words, laid back, alternatively behind the beat, push behind. In Norwegian, they translate pretty much the same: bak på beat, fram på beat, på beat. You know, so we gave them the opportunity to kind of decide for themselves and perform it. What I put into it, I mean, is a lot of based on what I've read. You know, from these various kind of different scholars. Talked a little bit on the trial lecture, what they consider these things lead to in terms of their effects. Also, in terms of, you know, performance. Physical patterns in the music. I mean, there's the kind of common, more simple understanding that it's one element later relative to another, you know, fixed physical element. But, you know, it can be, I think musicians often speak of it in a bit looser terms, because there's this kind of two-sided effect to it, right? If a drummer is playing behind of a bassist, then the drummer is playing ahead. The bassist is playing ahead of the drummer, right?
Yeah.
So like there's this one is pushing, one is laying back, depends on how you see it.
Yeah.
So it's, when you say, you know, especially when you instruct these people to do that, there's kind of one after the fact, almost, advantage of giving them a fixed timing reference. Because here it'll be, we assume it's more clear when we're talking about laid back, pushed, and on the beat, it's in relation to that timing reference. But it doesn't mean that, you know, in their own subjective, you know, idealization of that pulse, however it happens, again, internal oscillators, time clock, you know, clock mechanisms, there's something else going on there too. But, you know, it's always got this relativity aspect to it. And in the literature, again, there's so many descriptions of what that's supposed to produce. And how you do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was just thinking more about the meaning of the word in a way. I mean, if you look in the dictionary, you see it also laid back. It's explained as relaxed, for example. Okay? And relaxed, then I thought about relaxed is lack of energy. Can it be related to that in the music? Because music has more or less energy as well.
Yeah, the whole idea that, you know, music, especially rhythm, can convey different emotional qualities or states. I mean, when you say, you know, relax is related to, what did you say?
Energy.
Energy loss. Stewart spectrum considers too much laid back as, you know, tells a musician, go get some sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
You got too little energy, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, you got these metaphorical associations.
Yeah.
I mean, they're almost all description of music is metaphorical. You know, like the fact that it conveys movement. I mean, the ecological perspective, you know, is that, you know, we don't just imagine that, you know, the instrument, but we imagine that movement together, you know, in different ways, the kind of different actions in the environment that we perceive, we feel them. So laid back has definitely those associations. And pushed, on the other hand, has associations with nervousness or tension or stressedness, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that's kind of negatively connoted, at least in kind of definition, you know, layman definitions and stuff. But, I mean, I think, you know, in your studies with the swing ratios, you notice some bassists, you notice just like Keel, you know, saying some bassists prefer to push against, you know, the ride cymbal, like Eric, or not.
Yeah.
But then all of the other studies say, like, well, maybe that's in the case or not.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things that go into
it. But if you think about energy is also a physical measure.
Mm.
So you can actually estimate that in the music in a way. So, I mean, it's related to how strong you play the instrument, for example. The energy you put into the instrument. So, and that usually relates to dynamics.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, but...
So, your results did not show that entirely, because in that case, it would mean that laid back, it would also be softer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bit inconclusive. At some point, it was...
Was it the bass results?
The bass in the first study.
Pushed the players play the bass more intensely, and laid-back strokes softer.
So. But not the other instrument, and in particular drums. Not the drums, actually.
Yeah. No, for sure.
But you discussed this already, and it seems to be a bit inconsistent in the drums, how they treat the dynamics, actually. I don't know.
It's, I mean, as I suggested, talked a bit with Reiner, like you've got a lot more elements going on. We gave them just three, even though a real drum kit will have crash cymbals and ride cymbals and all these things. So, like, the kind of opportunities, or let's say also more specifically in the context of the experiment, these musicians, okay, they're just told very simply, do laid-back pushed on the beat. So they're going to, you know, preconceive of, like, what am I going to do here? Probably most of them thinking I'm going to try to, you know, physically place the stroke a little earlier. And as to what happens with intensity or these things, you know, I wonder, is it conscious or not? We did lots of post-interviews. Some musicians, you know, talked a lot about what they did with the sound. So I was thinking about the sound.
Mm.
But some had no clue. They're just like, I don't know, I just did what I did, you know? I don't think. Some people, you know, the drummers, again, since they showed so much variation in intensity or not, and not in any consistent way correlating with perceptual studies, predictions, you know, I think, like, it's a bit simple, but the best kind of explanation is that they use it maybe to highlight, you know, certain aspects. But in this experiment, what are they highlighting? You know, just the drums.
Yeah.
In real context. That
leads to another question that I was going to deal with later, but I think it would be interesting now to continue in this direction. The musician has a lot of different strategies, apparently, and I think you sort of implicitly say that some of them are better than the others, but
do I?
I've tried to a certain extent in the but that's in the last paper. But do you think they have always an optimal strategy? Maybe.
Well, if you think in the sense that, sorry to drop, but like that certain players have a notion of themselves as a something player, as a pushy player, as a laid-back player, as a very tight player.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the questions we asked in our post-interviews. I didn't really get to, you know, kind of analyze it properly, but it was one thing to talk, you know, do you think you're a pushy player? How do you think you approach the beat, you know, your time in the beat? So, like, for them, what's optimal Maybe they do have, but I still think it'll change from style to style. There was, again, a reggae drummer saying, in reggae, I want to play, you know, very tight with the guitar. You know, we're both supposed to be very tight. But when he plays, like, other styles, you know, that might not necessarily be the case. So optimal strategies for different...
Of course, for different... but in the context of this experiment, for example.
Well, I would hope that, you know, they saw it as very open. I mean... The whole kind of setting of the experiment was, you know, beginning talking to the musicians, like they were told what it was about, you know, and accepted whether they wanted to participate or not. Told them, like, there's going to be some experiments, we're going to tell you to do this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few that were uncomfortable. They said, like, no, I don't do that. I just play the way I play. I don't care about all this timing and sound stuff.
No, yeah.
But all those that came were like, they're kind of, you know, they're wary that this is a context where they can apply different things here. So, you know, but yeah, maybe there's an optimal ways. For each of those musicians, optimal ways to do laid back, optimal ways to do push, optimal ways to do on the beat. You know,
mm-hmm.
If in the last paper, like again, shows that there's all these different ways, three rough categories to play laid back or pushed.
Yeah, yeah. But for example, if you delay the whole pattern, like some of the drummers did,
yeah,
is that really a good strategy in a real ensemble? Because then it might lead to that the other members follow a little bit and then you go around with the tempo and,
yeah.
You know.
That's kind of, yeah, this idea, you know, that you'll push tempo if you consistently, you know.
Yeah.
It depends if the other, you know, you've got a bassist in the band who's rock solid,
mm-hmm.
You know, and he's like, he's not going to move that tempo a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Following him, you know. Then maybe, again, keep, like, pushing everything. But yeah, I think, like, in terms of this kind of general earliness or lateness strategy, is perhaps more of a, you know, a result of the artificial laboratory context than the other strategies. And, you know, so it's like, it's them, like, in this context, in order to, you know, do laid back, I'll do it like this, you know, like, whether they would use it in a real style, like, again, I mean, at least for, like, bassists constantly pushing against the drum, or a guitarist, because the drummer is usually seen as the heart, you know, of these, like, percussive styles with other instruments.
Okay.
They
yeah.
keep the, I don't know if that's your experience, right? I find it is myself, even though everybody contributes to the general, you know, pulse and tempo, but this kind of, you know, there's some, bring back reggae a lot, but there's some reggae songs that are a mix of, you know, performed in the studio and then digitally edited afterwards, where it's just the bass is just constantly coming really late, and not just late, but with these, like, big wobbly sounds, you know?
Yeah.
So that happens a lot. Of course, we didn't look at bassists and guitarists via the method in the third paper, mainly because it fell outside, you know, the time and the scope, but... yeah, what they would do probably would have this mix of, you know, always ahead, always behind, or ahead and behind at certain locations, you know,
yeah.
The beat.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Can I ask, sorry to interrupt, because you say that I imply
that
there are better ways than others.
Yeah, you get you give certain examples. I cannot give the exact citation now, but...
Well, I just want to clarify.
You give certain examples in the third paper, actually, of examples where it sort of works well.
I think I've mentioned that, you know, with the backbeat groove,
yeah.
A lot of people claim that laid-back is the preferred approach in many different kind of styles.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that I think that. You know, again, the Motown example or the Stax, I think I mentioned, and, you know, like, I was just trying to find examples of where are these different, you know, feels more typically applied to. I mean, I guess I do suggest that certain feels are applied more or associated more commonly with certain, you know, styles than others. So it does imply that in those styles, you know, pushed wouldn't be as good, you know. But I mean, you know, kind of trying to leave my personal opinions aside. And to be honest, I've become so much more open to the possibility of different timings. Performance after this PhD than before. But yeah. So maybe, you know, I think we all kind of have maybe our own aesthetic, you know, judgments, but again, this content of this experiment, it was very open. So it's to see, like, what happens, you know, when you give them this openness, and are there these somewhat more universal kind of trends, at least in that context.
Yeah, well, while I was thinking, I was sort of fishing around for what would be my last question, but I put it here instead. I mean, what can you bring back to the musicians? What can you provide that they can learn from here?
Well, I mentioned it to Reiner, Dr. Polak, And this is something that I've, you know, attempted myself now, like, especially when it comes to the guitar. I'm a guitarist. If you ask people in this experiment to play laid back, the majority will stretch out their strokes. They'll play a longer attack, they'll sweep it instead of strike it, and they'll also let it ring out a little bit longer. And this is a strong effect. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I've often, you know, I play very, you know, upbeat and high tempo music where, you know, I always think, like, you know, you got to be on the beat, because, like, you got to be tight and so on.
Yeah.
But then it often leads me to be, like, a bit pushy, you know? So the idea, not just, you know, that I've applied, but to musicians, the potential is like, all right, you're going to try to be less pushy or on the beat, if that's what you desire, that's what you consider good in that style or not, no judgment. Then try to think longer tones, or longer strokes, longer, you know, swept, slower attacks. Maybe the brightness thing is a little bit more, you know, more related to what kind of sounds you choose for your guitar, you know, there.
Mm.
And this is just the backbeat, so I think that could have something there. It's kind of a training technique. The opposite for pushed, if you actually want to, like, push the beat a bit, or even just be very precisely on the beat relative to, again, someone, like a drummer. Maybe, you know, play a little bit more staccato. Play a little bit more, you know, don't just think late, early. Think, like, slow, long, you know.
So basically, suggest to also work on the sound features.
Think
basically.
Of sound features, I guess, when you're trying to achieve different timings. Because, I mean, a lot of people do talk about, you know, there's one one music teacher who was a bassist, was also a music teacher. Like, he teaches young kids, and often when they just tell them to play, they're going to play, they start to play really loud, you know, with no, like, finesse. And that loudness leads them to, like, increase in tempo, you know, the whole time. Like,
yeah.
Say, high energy is,
yeah,
you know, rushed, kind of. You know?
Yeah.
So his technique is usually like, all right, kids, calm down. Play a little softer. Play dynamically softer.
Yeah.
And that often leads directly to them not, you know, rushing the tempo.
Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's connect. You know, musicians sometimes do think of this. You know, so timing and sound. They're, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them can be useful to achieve.
Yeah, so there you have the direct energy connection, which is more visible for beginners then.
Mm.
I mean, because you train to avoid these kind of connections as a musician.
I think if you did an experiment, you know, where we let no metronome in this same paradigm that, like Dr. Pollack was saying, you probably see that a bit, or depending on how expert they are, really, they tell them to play louder and pushed, you know, will they increase their tempo? Possible the chances are there, you know, you have all these metaphorical associations, and a physical connection.
Okay, let's go back to the technical stuff, the boring stuff, a little bit.
See if I remember.
Although this is very interesting discussions. First of all, I wondered about the onset, which is of course very important here, the onset detection here. One very basic thing is the latency of the equipment, which I think you were pretty aware of when you did the setup in some way. But did you actually measure the latency that or the timing that was heard by the musicians?
Yeah.
Separately, or because that's not mentioned actually.
I thought I had mentioned it because we did measure it. We looked at, you know, because you had from the sound card to an analog mixer, and then from the analog mixer, like, straight to the musicians. But then we did some recordings of that signal that was coming out of the analog mixer.
Yeah.
And then we looked, and it was, like, minuscule.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sample or two.
Oh, okay, okay.
For,
yeah,
for
yeah.
100,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So if I didn't mention the value in the thesis, then...
I don't think so, actually. Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. I think in the experiment with the drums, they had the click in the headphones.
Yeah.
But they listened to their own sound acoustically, right?
It was a semi.
Semi-isolated
headphones.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had the opportunity to do both, really.
So there is actually a little delay in the air.
Sure.
Which these kind of things gets a little. I mean, they start to get important in some context, like now.
But, I mean, but the drums are right in front of them.
Yeah, yeah, but
so
still a few milliseconds, actually, just by there, actually.
But, I mean, you know, consider that in real life, concert stage situations, musicians are dealing with way more than this, you know, up to 20, 30 milliseconds, a guitarist away from his amp, you know, on stage. It's significant.
That's why the feedback they have is so important, I guess.
Minimizes it, you know, I guess. And, you know, effects of reverb are super interesting, but...
Okay. Okay, and then the P center. Let's get into the P center. You spend 6 pages in the summary discussing this, and you are also summarizing it in the papers. And I was reading the first paper. Interesting. You talk about P center, and I was expecting that you would use it for the recordings then. And so, finally, use the physical onset, which is the most obvious physical parameter, maybe.
And
I suppose you had the intention to use the P center. I guess that, no?
Well, in a way, yes. But, I mean, consider, P center is not an objective measure. It's a perceptual... It's the artifact of a perceptual, you know, laboratory experiment, not laboratory, a listening experiment. It's a theoretical concept too, but even that theoretical concept and the, you know, frameworks that have been developed and methoded, you can't actually measure the direct P center of anything. It's always the P center of one sound relative to another. So in order to, I mean, you can't take it from the physical signal. You have to present the physical signal, a stroke, whatever, to a listener, and then in relation to another sound, which you assume to be perfect, have like a zero P center, basically, such as a click, and that's taken as a proxy for your infallible timekeeper, if there's such a thing.
Yeah.
Then how much you either adjust that to synchrony in this context, or isochronous, make it isochronous from another P center. You get it. You know, got to go through all these extra steps, and essentially you can only do that for a single sound at a time, and it takes, you know, hours to do it for a couple of participants. So, I mean, yeah, I did have the idea, what if I, you know, I'll measure the onset, of course, because that's right there, but then I'll compare it to P centers, mean P centers, and don't forget that it's not just the point, it's been envisioned as, you know, having
This is a good idea, by the way, I think.
But you got to do that, and then, you know, I'll compare the onset values with the peak and the theoretical P centers. Problem is, you know, okay, each individual performance, and we're talking about hundreds of performances by, you know, in each condition by all these musicians, in each of the performances, you know, okay, you could get the average sound, maybe, but what's an average sound? You know, how are you going to physically produce an average sound out of, like, 27 strokes? And you know... Like, you can't synthesize that without it sounding artificial, I suppose, right? I mean, you could choose a representative sound, the most one, perhaps.
Yeah.
If I'd done that, and then, you know, again, for each individual guitarist, I'd have to do that, for each individual bassist. And so, yeah, I did some pilot tests during the kind of experiment setup, but I found out this takes way too much time. It'll be super convoluted to look at all these different things. You know, systematically, in a consistent, you know, way that I'm talking about. But I could have, you know, could have kind of used some heuristic values too. Problem is, you don't have that good, you know, that many heuristic values for guitar, electric guitar, for example. The experiments that Fraser Dennison have done here, one of the more recent, you know, researchers to take this up again, most of the studies are, you know, from like a couple of decades ago. You don't have a lot of ground data on the actual P centers of experience. I'm sorry to just interject, but context, you know? Single sound in a repetitive context, you're going to get the P center of that sound in that simple repetitive context. You're not going to get it in a more polyphonic, you know, just like the J&D, like, you know, heuristics. So it's, I would say it's not really feasible, but onset and then relating it theoretically to, you know, I was more attracted to kind of the, or actually the whole project was inspired by P center studies to a large extent, because they're the ones that are showing it. Change the acoustic envelope of a sound, and your, you know, perception of synchrony or asynchrony is going to change. So, okay, well then, what happens in performance is one of the, you know, questions that kind of arise.
Yeah, yeah. But still, you need some reference, and one reference is the onset. And then the good thing is that you use also the peak in that study, and in the later study, in the third paper, you just compare the different. And so in that case, you don't need the absolute sort of p-center, I suppose. So is it's not so extremely problematic. It's more maybe in relation to this NMA aspect, for example. Is it before or after or not?
Well, I agree. Know. I kind of looked, consider that with the guitar and bass stuff, mainly because we did both onset peak in that paper. In the drums, we didn't do both onset peak because they're very close. But I mentioned, okay, this whole concept of NMA, when you're doing on the beat synchronization or in phase, all these studies showing that. I mean, I think it was Rush, in 1979 or whatever, who was saying that probably the peak center. There is an onset NMA, but people are kind of synchronizing it a bit later. So I don't know if let's say right now you take some heuristic thresholds of P center or mean P centers, NMA can probably be accounted by this kind of P center effect to a certain degree. I actually did it on the drums too. If you consider P centers of 1 to 5 milliseconds for drums, right? And I also did peak analysis even though it was in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it could seem that, the P centers are probably close to the peaks, and the peaks don't necessarily have NMA. But that wasn't the case for all of them. Like the snare and the hi-hat, especially the hi-hat that you can really, stretch out a little bit, by opening it a bit. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a kind of direct correlation with any theoretical P center. But that's also because the hi-hat P center means that we have, from the Sedano study, it's like a closed, tight hi-hat. Mm-hmm. It's not, a big open one.
Okay, yeah.
But so you're
hi-hat
right,
is complicated.
Yeah, I should have done more, but it's more about how systematic I was going to be.
Yeah.
Didn't really have time.
Yeah, I run into the problem with when you close the hi-hat by the foot, know. Hmm. Where is the onset of this guy?
True.
It's the end of the sound, I suppose.
You create a double onset, really.
Yeah.
Like the bass. Whoops.
It's the opposite, sort of. It's the inverse of an impulse sound.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny. Okay, good. No, I would think. I mean, yeah. I leave this subject for the moment. Do you have the slide, the first one there?
Let's see. Is what here?
Yeah. Very simple. Just summary of the sound descriptors you used, which you had also a much better slide previously. So you had onset position, peak position, three types of duration, three types of spectral centroid, three types of SPL. And I wonder, in general, what was the a priori idea about choosing all these parameters at that point, in particular the different parts of the envelope. I don't think there's nothing discussed about that, why you choose a certain parameter setup.
Right. So, again, the prototype for this experimental paradigm was developed by Danielson and colleagues, and they looked at onset, spectral centroid, the total sound, temporal centroid of the sound,
mm-hmm.
and also total intensity. So, building upon that, I thought, okay, let's look at duration, because duration has strong, perceptual correlates of P center.
Yeah.
So then I have, intensity, duration, and I cut temporal centroid because I found that it's really difficult to,
studies
what does that perceptually correlate with.
Yeah.
So spectral centroid, duration, and intensity. but P center suggests it's both attack duration in particular as well as the total from onset to offset.
Yeah.
So let's separate duration. Boom. You got attack and total, but hey, now you've got decay too. you know?
Yeah, but they are connected. I mean, they
of course they're connected. Yeah. But you know, attack to peak or attack, you know, onset to the attack is attack, decay, etc. And they're connected, they say. But again, Russell thought, okay, in the guitarist's example, kind of theorized it like, well, if they're going to stretch things out, where is it going to be? Is that stretching out after the attack or before the attack?
Yeah.
So you could say maybe total and decay could be collapsed in that case, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, then it wouldn't well, yeah, you would get how much the attack is stretched or not, mm-hmm. just from attack, you don't
yeah.
decay. You notice, like, I don't really focus that much on the decay duration and talk about the total, because they are, as you say, connected.
Yeah.
But, you know, so splitting all these other the intensity and spectrocentroid, it's like, okay, we've already got these points that we've measured, you know, laboriously. Let's just look at those two, even if they don't necessarily have specific kind of perceptual, you know, correlates of, oh, the tack spectrocentroid. I mean, maybe that does actually, you know, the tack segment.
Yeah.
Temporal differences is quite important, right? But intensity, I mean, the beginning intensity versus, you know, the total, kind of hard to maybe analyze.
I don't see how you conceptualize that
right.
in some way.
So it's a bit artificial, but you see that, you know, that's how it kind of developed, and then you've got all these features
yeah.
and calculated them all. But which ones we used in, you know, the papers, you know, certain, like again, spectrocentroid for drums because of the contact microphones, as I wrote, like how we kind of perceive those signals is, there's just not really any research on it, you know? I didn't think it was kind of perceptually valid. But
yeah, I mean, it can be a good strategy to throw in everything, sort of, you can imagine, a little bit more.
It's a net. Yeah.
It has the problem, though, that since you're using statistics, then you will do a lot of statistical tests. And that's a basic problem. It also makes the analysis a lot more complicated, actually, more than it necessarily needed to be, I think. On the other hand, I see a clear development here towards less and less features over the papers.
Well, I mean, you know, the main difference between one and two is really the, okay, it's peak and spectrocentroid. Spectrocentroid is because of the clear technical, you know, impossibility. And
why it is impossible?
Oh, not impossibility, but again, that you can measure the spectrocentroid of these contact microphone signals, but if I'm going to try to, if I were to relate them how they are perceived in terms of, you know, brightness, there's not really any kind of studies that I can connect
yeah.
to.
And you cannot use the acoustic. You sound there, no.
Oh yeah, they're so dirty. You mentioned that, you know, so much bleed.
Oh, okay,
leakage.
So it was technical reasons
yeah.
there, because I've thought about spectrocentroid should be, could be at least a potential parameter that is changed independently, because you can play in different ways, different positions on the drum, for example.
Yeah, no, well, Danielson and colleagues, because they only did snare drum, sound capture.
Yeah.
I think they use a plastic hi-hat and an electronic bass drum.
Okay.
So they were able to capture that snare signal
yeah.
fully and isolated.
Okay.
I tried, you know, we tried different configurations of trying to put like plastic, you know, shields.
Oh, okay, around, okay.
But
yeah.
it didn't work. So that's why I couldn't look at the spectrocentroid of the clean, you know, non-contact microphone signal. Just too blended with the hi-hat
yeah.
and bass.
Oh. Mm.
But yeah, I told you, onset, we cut out peak for the drums because they tend to be quite close. There could have been a discussion in presentations, you know, outside of, you know, the paper I've talked about it. You know, this peak position maybe accounts for the kind of the on NMA thing, but not fully. It would just kind of be, you've seen the papers, a lot of tests. And
yeah.
Especially with pattern and timing reference
we
wanted to look at.
Okay, let's go on to the next slide there, which is also a picture from your, from the first paper, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Guitar on the top and bass on the bottom there, and there is the computed envelope, and then there's the onset, and the onset was determined in another way by some kind of waveform method, but it was different to how you did in paper 2 and 3, right? Or was it the same?
No, the onset calculation was the same for all the papers.
Ah, there was for all the papers. Okay.
No, we didn't want to use the envelope point of the onset because, as you see, there's this discrepancy.
Yeah. In fact, if you look at the envelope here, so we see that this attack here is much faster on the base, but it has the same slope, the envelope. It's even a little bit less on this one.
Yeah.
So the slope of the envelope is just sort of reflecting the window size of the computation, which is low-pass filtering. So it's the maximum slope, more or less, in this way.
Exactly in this area, you know, I recruited the help and co-authorship of Olivier Bartillo. To look at, like, okay, how can we get as more, you know, precise an onset calculation as possible? Because, you know,
yeah,
he developed a new, you know, algorithm for the mutual box.
Okay.
To get a more precise onset for a single sound, at least, analysis.
Still, I think maybe this peak is a bit behind the
real
peak.
Well, I mean, this is schematic, mind you. These figures are schematic.
They are not the real measurements?
No. Well, I mean, it's more like in order to, you know, show which features and from where to where, this figure is a schematic one. So if you want to look at how the actual envelopes are for each individual sound.
But it is the envelope from the bass, no?
Yeah, from that instrument, but
okay.
I think, like, again, in terms of compressing, like, a certain few features in what you would call it, a graphic editor to fit it all in and nicely. it doesn't really have any implications for what we calculated. The calculations were done with the...
I thought it was a real example here, but...
I mean, it probably is, mind you.
It's close.
Yeah, very close.
Anyway, okay.
Very close. I mean, it shows that using that envelope calculation, you will get a different onset point if you, you know, put it there.
Yeah, absolutely. And this calculation seems to be pretty good according to the pictures, anyway. Now the problem is, how do you calculate the spectral centroid for the attack on this base?
The simple answer is that, you know, you input the values
into the algorithm. I know. You can always input the values into the algorithm, but the algorithm produces some number.
Yeah, you're talking about kind of the limits of, you know, the window of calculation that you use and how how much it can really represent.
For example, how big was the window? You never mentioned that for the...
Really?
Spectral centroid. No.
Well, I guess it's because it's the default of the mirror toolbox.
You mentioned some kind of default that is 30 milliseconds.
That's possible. I'd have to have the technical details.
But, okay. Yeah. Because here it's just one period of the sound, you know.
What you're saying is, you know, it doesn't really produce maybe that intuitive or even technically valuable.
No, that's what I was aiming for. Yeah, you get the number, but the interpretation is
no doubt. But that's why I think, you know, when it came to the total or the spectral centroid, I think it was mainly in the total that the results were significant, or at least like I would talk about. Okay, if there's something there, let's look at the total sound, because I agree with you. You know, the spectral center of just this minute attack segment. What is
I think they were all pointing to
all
the boards the same, basically.
Yeah, towards the same.
So, which was a good...
Right.
So it didn't make any harm, basically.
Right. But you're right. It's maybe, you know, not really necessary and not informative, anyways.
Okay. Now... over to the SPL measurements or the estimations. It looks like from the description, it's not mentioned that you actually use the full duration of the segment you want to estimate and take the whatever, I suppose the RMS value or something.
RMS value, then convert it to decibels, average of the whole.
So averaging the whole thing.
All the performances, I think. Strokes.
Yeah, so...
But I mean, not the full, you mean this kind of cut in the bass? especially.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get some kind of average value across the sound, I suppose, in this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would that be the perceptually relevant measure?
As opposed to?
For example, as compared to if you take the peak.
The peak intensity.
Yeah. For a percussive sound, for example.
No, you're right. I mean, maybe the closest thing you'll get then is the attack intensity, even though it's not of the point, but it's the average of that duration from onset to... I mean, you're right in terms of, you know, which ones are...
I don't know myself, but, you know...
I don't know either.
But this is tricky.
Had you mentioned that to me during my studies, I would have included that, because, I mean, the maximum, you know, intensity of that sound, it might have also, you know...
Yeah.
Implications, or it may be a salient perceptual point. But I mean, do you know of any studies that kind of, you know, talk about the loudness of sounds is perceived, you know, mainly from its attack or its total duration? Because I couldn't really find necessarily, you know.
There is some work on sound level of percussive sound, yeah, impulse sound. I mean, it's not related to music. It's. It's a noise kind of related issues, but I don't know it in detail either. Actually, yeah. I should actually but study it. But this is really missing. We don't even know what is a perceptually loud sound for different envelopes, right?
Right. And even the whole just noticeable differences of intensities in a rhythmic context, I don't think it's really been done. It's always in this kind of solo presentations of two sounds right after another, you know?
Yeah. It's not easy. It's like with the P center, it's going to be complicated.
Exactly.
But still, it would be good to have a little bit more knowledge in this area, I think.
Wow.
Okay. Then another thing, just talking, continuing with the spectral centroid, it increases with increased dynamics, usually in instruments. In most acoustical instruments, including all the string instruments, and also in most percussion instruments. however, sometimes actually the correlation is... it's not so strong. And sometimes the correlation is negative. For example, for the bass in paper one, there is a negative correlation between these two.
It sounds weird.
Yeah.
According to this, as you say.
Maybe it's possible by changing playing techniques, but...
I don't have a technical answer for that. I did go back to the correlation results. I don't think there's an error in calculation, but then I haven't had to redo all the calculations. It's one thing that could contribute to it is this cutting of the kind of offset segment, and that mm-hmm. was done because a lot of players slap the end.
Yeah.
No. So we thought, okay. Yeah, you could probably go in and adaptively like have a different window for each stroke, but that would have come with no problems. Okay, maybe that kind of process affected the spectral centroid kind of calculations. But I'd say, again, going back to the original prototype study by Dennison, they also found that for drummers, for the snare, and it was just the snare that they measured, the louder it was played, the lower the spectral centroid.
Uh-huh.
And they also uh-huh. said, "Well, yeah, this is unexpected
yeah.
in terms of predicted results from standard studies, who generally report a higher correlation, a positive association between spectral centroid intensity."
Mm-hmm.
They found okay, and they had the clean drum snare signals.
Yeah.
So I think they related it to it's possible to have the different play positions in the snare that the drummers can, strike.
Mm-hmm.
And some will, excite certain frequencies more than others.
Yeah.
So even intensity can produce a darker tone in the snare drummers. Maybe it's the same case here with the bassist, that mean, you've also got, you know, the magnetic pickup, how it kind of reacts to, you know, what they're physically doing. There's a certain amount of compression that's going in on the analog emulator that we used, you know.
Yeah, that's another kind of...
But that's to give them some realism.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
How bassists play, they have an amp, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're now Rogers and well, mm-hmm. he plays guitar, but he doesn't use no amp.
Yeah,
he uses a preamp.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So there
there are many parameters. Like in the drum, if you strike in the middle, you get less high frequencies, basically. Mm-hmm. If you go, the more you go towards the rim, you get more high frequency, right?
But well, we've done motion capture, as I've talked to you about before, and I was actually looking at the guitarists, you know, where are they striking on the bridge to neck.
Yeah.
It's actually very interesting to look at these bass correlation results too and see, is this something related to where they're playing? Because again, the idea that, you know, it's brighter, closer to the neck.
Exactly, Yeah, it's the same thing in the guitar string, of course.
Yeah. Exactly. So that could be a clue, yeah.
Yeah. And talking about the guitar, when they strike in this slow way, it's like an arpeggio, right?
Almost, yeah.
Where is the perceptual onset there?
They would definitely be like further away from the onset than in a
swing. Yeah. Definitely. But is it, I would expect it to be arpeggio like before the beat, right? So at the last note would be the onset.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something they...
Yeah, I think, there was one reviewer who noted a guitarist who had, like, really, like, done that kind of thing. You know, they played on the beat.
Yeah.
But it was the peak that was aligned with on the beat, not the onset.
Yeah.
So that was a really extreme case. That's one way to do it, you know, and...
If it's enough slow, maybe
it's enough slow,
you can do that.
Yeah.
If it's in the middle, I don't know. It's an interesting case of.
To say arpeggiated, at what point is it not just, you know, slowly swept, but it's arpeggiated, and you can hear the individual, you know, tones of the chord.
Yeah, yeah.
It just shows, you know, different players can kind of. But when it is long, super long. The longer it is, then I think it's definitely, you know, more towards that peak, the last tone.
Yeah, yeah.
To that.
That's the one case, of course, there where this P center stuff is having problem, I guess.
That P center of, you know, multiple attacks.
Yeah, yeah.
That hasn't been studied almost at all.
Yeah. Okay. Some last questions here. you had one tempo and one pattern, or two patterns. you think it would be a lot different in other tempi or
tempi? Back to the source, Professor Dennis and the colleague study. They did 96 like us.
Yeah.
Now together, they also did super fast like 140.
Yeah.
And one at 64.
Yeah.
Mainly they found, and again they were just looking at snare differences, but they in terms of onsets, you know, like differences kind of magnify. Or onset in the slower, like J&D studies, you know, like would predict as well. But in the faster ones, all the differences kind of were just really diminished, both timing and sound that they looked at.
Uh-huh.
So the idea is that, okay, at least at very fast tempos, we're not going to test this because it's also really difficult for the musicians to play at a high tempo.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it could have graded it in certain tempos, but that would add to the already... very many factors in the analysis. But I think like just like perceptual thresholds of asynchrony or anisochrony or swing or whatever, they're probably dependent on tempo changes, right? Or they are dependent on tempo changes. So in performance as well, like what they're able to produce.
I mean, in the swing pattern, you see a big difference with tempo. this is more like asynchronous. And maybe they are less sensitive to tempo changes, actually.
You think so? But I mean, in a very fast tempo, where like...
A very fast is, yeah.
And a very large, again, with the whole like...
But, I mean, if it's really slow, you cannot be delayed proportionally the same amount. It would sound ridiculous, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It would totally be out of sync.
you know, it would be like
because the threshold for asynchrony is more. I don't know how much it scaled with tempo. Maybe nothing. You know.
Well, that's the thing. There's not many studies of asynchrony with IOI rate. Is more anisochrony in IOI rate.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
It's another one of those, you know.
There's no studies on that. Lots
yet,
of stuff to do.
Yet, if you let me, I'll do it.
Okay, so something you discussed already with Rainer was the condition here, the experimental condition with the fixed reference. And we discussed also actually before, so I don't know if there is anything more to say about that. Actually, I think we clarified it already when I think about it. And we talked about the musicians. If you say then, let me just check a little bit here. I think a lot of stuff was covered. Yeah, the number of statistical tests. I almost forgot. Okay. So, in the papers, you did something like 20 ANOVAs in each. In each paper, I think.
There are at least enough.
And then on top of that, you did a lot of t-tests on almost all parameters. Do you know how many t-tests you did? Because I was not able to count them.
Well, for all the main effects, for example, you know, if there was a main effect, do it for all those. We're talking about onset timing conditions, so it's three times for kind of main effect. When it came to the interaction effects, we'd only do follow-up kind of, you know, t-tests or Wilcoxons if there was a, you know, interaction effect. So for main effects, it was kind of omnibus, but for the interaction stuff, then it was just targeted, you know, like, is there something here? Which conditions, you know, metronome, instrument, pattern, and so on.
Yeah, yeah. But so, it was in a post-hoc fashion. I mean, you saw some differences that you wanted to check if it's significant in a way, actually. T-test, in my statistics book, it's not considered a post-hoc test, but a priori test. Did you consider any other kind of post-hoc test, like Turkey or something like that?
I mean, you know, when I was going through the possibilities of how to, and also learning to do these ANOVAs as, you know, the psychological literature usually does it, you know, as I can't recall and I don't know which one's best to use. Eventually, I mean, I consulted some statisticians and also other people, especially at the psychology department, you know, have done these things before. It's like, all right, Bonferroni, you know, correction and t-test, it's pretty standard. But I mean, that doesn't mean, okay, maybe particularly when it comes to whether t-test, you know, Tukey is it, or what is it, HSD or something, like.
Yeah, there are a number
are
of different of different post-hoc tests you can use in different situations. It's not easy to get into that, no?
No, I mean.
I struggled also. But.
I struggled too, so therefore I kind of went for, you know, the conventional approach.
And, yeah,
tried to be careful, I mean, again, when it came to, like, what kind of corrections, not just in the t-tests, but the, you know, the ANOVAs and stuff, which ones to use.
Yeah.
And I guess I went for, tried to go for the most conservative ones, you know, where possible. And I know you asked about the correction of, you know, which corrections and how many for which pairs and so on. I mean, for the main effects, it was just, there's three pairs, laid back on, laid back pushed.
Okay.
But when you go deeper into either the instrument, the reference, or the pattern type. For those, again, I just tried to look at which ones make sense to look at. If I'm looking at instrument versus metronome, I'm not going to do, or the notes, right? Beat 1, 2, 3, and 4, I'm not going to do everything to everything. Those are a bit more like targeted. Do the kind of conditions that just look at effects of.
Yeah, yeah. But still, there's a danger in particular if you get significance is close to the limit, you know.
Yeah.
You get close to 95% something. You. I mean, it's good. It's wise to consider. Is that really, really something important? Mm. And in this case, you also compared with the JNDs, which I think is very good to put it in context. And so you did some kind of evaluation of the size. Of the differences, and I think this makes it much better, actually.
Well, much better would have been to do perceptual listening experience too, but again,
yeah,
that's for a postdoc.
Okay, so I just would like to finish now with these experiments are very detailed. There's a lot of stuff and a lot of results, and I got a bit dizzy at some time when I was reading.
Try doing that for 4 years.
Yeah. And so you already summarized everything in your presentation, but if you would summarize even a bit more, what is the take-home message for today?
It's a bit partly connected to what we talked about before, is that in performance, whether in actual playing or the analysis of by scholars and stuff, when you're talking about microrhythm, you should really think about how the shape of sounds are, how do they influence either objective measures of timing or perceived measures of timing. That's where the scholars, the musicians, maybe a lot already think of sound, but do they connect it with timing? And, becoming more aware of that can be a pedagogical tool as well. So, those are, this twofold, research and performance as well. The whole concept of microrhythm as involving both timing and sound interactions is a really valuable one that I think can tell us a lot more about what musicians do when they are trying to groove and why they do it,
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Freeberg.
Thank you very much for creating another intellectually stimulating and exciting dialogue. It is much appreciated. I wonder if there's someone who wants to speak as an opponent ex auditorio here or from the webinar. That doesn't seem to be the case. Then on behalf of the Faculty of Humanities, I would like to thank the candidate, the evaluation committee, and the opponents for having carried out this doctoral disputation in a critical, interesting, and inspiring manner. I now declare the proceedings are over. A report will be made to the university board, and the disputation is hereby over. Thank you very much, and have a great weekend. And we'll see you at the reception at 3:00.